here from California on our way of a fall trip around the United States, just jumping in wherever I can find a frequency that's active, and I'm interested in your conversation about the structure of molecules and the nature of space, inner and outer. You sound like a very knowledgeable individual, and I'm interested in your conversation.
There's a man with good taste. I'm having some fun with you, Tom. Tom, what you're listening to is, this is the technical net that has run in the New York City area since September of 1982. It's a bunch of guys who get together in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut, and we teach each other this stuff. We may sound like we know it all. We don't. This is the blind leading the blind, and we're slowly finding out about all this stuff, John. But it's been around for a long time, this particular technical net, and this is technical net number 1,373. Each time I send it back to you, Tom, make sure you wait for four separate beeps. Otherwise, you time out this machine. This is a whole network of two separate repeaters with an internet connection to IRLP and a echo link connection and so on. You time all of that out if you don't wait for the four beeps. So we're not quite that smart. We're trying to sound like we are, Tom. N6 Tango Sierra Lima, K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick.
Well, the more we think we know, the more we don't know. And with nanotechnology increasing in importance, and a chaos theory, and the importance of things like quantum mechanics and quantum entanglement just boggles the mind what there is yet for us all to learn.
Hey, you just heard the four beeps after you dropped your carrier. You have to make sure you wait for those four beeps. You got to train yourself on that one, Tom. And yeah, we're fairly sure there's a lot more unknown than there is known. So, as I was saying to you before, John, KC2WGB is going to take it next. I don't think the schools I went to gave me anywhere near that physical picture, that image of what an air molecule really looks like in the room, and where air pressure is coming from, and where sound is coming from, and the temperature of air, what it really means. One of the questions, these guys have heard it quite often, Tom, but you ask somebody who you think is a good scientist, why does the bottom of my bicycle pump get hot when I'm pumping up a tire? Very simple sounding question. Let me drop.
And then whiskey with a question later.
It's a very simple sounding question, but it's not. We all learn the P equals NRT, that equation and everything that goes behind it. That law tells you how much, doesn't tell you how or why. And so we're slowly finding out all about all this. John, for a comment before we turn it back to Wesley. KC2WGB, K2LIB.
That lack of pressure is only equal to the atmospheric pressure that is negating. But have you ever heard about or studied the original steam engine before they invented the slide valve?
When you said that the vacuum is where the air pressure has been negated, you gotta be careful now. Vacuum is where you've taken those individual air molecules and removed them from the equation. Be careful you don't start talking about the word suction. There is no such thing as suction. You get air pressure, more and less of it, but there is no suction. Yes, it acts like there's suction. When I suck on that straw to bring that milk or that soda up to my mouth, it feels like I'm doing it with suction. I'm creating a lower air pressure in my mouth, and the air pressure on the outside pushing down on the fluid is what pushes it up into the straw. So there is no real suction. I think you know that. But real vacuum, when you and I run a vacuum pump, we've got to remove all of those air molecules. And because they're bouncing around in that chamber, let me drop. They're bouncing around in that chamber on average at room temperature at 500 meters per second. There's a whole bunch of those pesky air molecules that never find the hole that goes to the hose that goes to the vacuum pump. Until you've run a really good vacuum pump for a long period of time, some significant number of air molecules left in that chamber that you think you're sweeping a vacuum into. You try to sweep all the air out of there. So very difficult to remove them all. And there are vacuums and there are vacuums, as you know. They did that, NASA did that experiment where they dragged a sheet of metal behind the space shuttle and had some kind of very sensitive vacuum-sensing device on the far side of that sheet metal to find out what kind of vacuum you could really get. I vaguely remember they came up to something like 10 to the minus 14 torr, 10 to the minus 14 torricelli. And you and I could calculate what that means as to how many air molecules are left per cubic meter, and it's still a significant number. You're starting off with 10 to the 23 power air molecules per cubic meter, per cubic foot. You know, a gram liter of air, a gram mass of air is Avogadro's number roughly per cubic foot. So getting them all out of there is really tough. Over to you, John, first, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, even with my mercury pump, I could not achieve vacuum as well as I'd like. So, yeah, there's a lot to be desired there. But I was speaking before the steam engine, just to give you an idea of the strength of our atmospheric pressure. Before the slide valve was invented, what they would do is they had a large chamber with a piston, which they would apply steam to, which would raise the piston, and they would inject a small amount of cold water into it. Did you ever hear about that system?
It sounds like it's a fairly slow, it sounds like it could be quite efficient, but slow acting. What kind of cycles per second could you get out of, or cycles per minute could you get out of that kind of a machine, John? Go ahead.
Well, they had to abandon it because the machines would actually destroy themselves. The air pressure that was trying to return the piston, the steam would collapse almost instantaneously in the zone, and the piston would return, and of course they could not compensate for it. And then once the slide valve came along, then it was just steam pushing steam with the piston in the center. But that was an amazing thing to read about. You would like to see that machine.
And where did you find that article? Is that on the one of the Wikipedias, John? Go ahead.
No, we studied that device in mechanical engineering way back in the dark ages. They probably didn't have it right either, but it was a very interesting concept. It was extremely strong, but even flywheels and things like that could not help. Everything was destroyed. It would break pistons, wrist pins, all kinds of crazy stuff.
So I think you're saying that once the cold water hit the steam contracted back into a fluid from gaseous to a liquid that rapidly, and therefore things got slammed real fast. Is that what you're saying, John?
Exactly right, Dick. In fact, it would even collapse the cylinder sometimes. It was amazingly effective.
Many of us have seen that experiment that's done in physics classes where you take a metal container, something like an oil can in the old days when they were made out of metal, boil a little bit of water in the bottom of the can so there's nothing but steam inside, close off the cap on the top of the can and take it away from the flame, and as the steam inside compresses, that can acts like it's in an extremely hard vacuum. It's not, of course, but it acts like it, and the can really gets crushed. Air pressure is pretty potent stuff. Water pressure is pretty potent also. By the same token, the average person doesn't realize how close he is to getting into a lot of trouble when he parks his automobile at a dockside. You park alongside of a dock where people are fishing. And if anything goes wrong when you start up the automobile, where it's in reverse and you think it's in forward or vice versa, if anything goes wrong so that the car goes into the water, the average person, his first response is to roll up the windows to keep the water out. You do that, and there's a high probability you're going to die. The right thing to do when you are trained and you think about it ahead of time is, of course, never take the keys out of the car while you're sitting there so that you have the ability to turn on the ignition, so you have the ability to operate the electric windows. Let me drop. But the right answer is to roll the windows down. because the only way you're going to leave that vehicle if it goes into the water is you're going to swim out the window. Arnold Schwarzenegger would not open the door when there's more than a foot of water, you know, above the edge of the door on the outside. Even if it's just slowly rolling down the hill into the water, you're not going to open that door, even though you think you are. So, I think something like five people on Long Island die in that scenario every year because they make the mistake of rolling up the windows, or the windows are rolled up and they didn't roll them down as the vehicle went into the water. So it's something you got to think about ahead of time. N2XJN. K2RIW. Go right ahead, Wesley.
Hey, good evening, everyone. I wonder how deep you were able to get into the material that I have sent you. Thank you for mentioning that book. It's 6,000 pages. It's not going to take a week. It took me very few months to analyze it, but that was 2 years ago. And actually, I would like to thank you because you were the one who triggered everything. I remember at the beginning of year 2010, I was fascinated with TechNet. And there was a time when I actually joined the TechNet. I was looking at the material that would possibly be good for discussion, which later on became a habit for me. And, I was constantly preparing myself for this up.
I think you've got the preset private machine monitor.
Yeah, we're hearing a little bit of echo in the background now, John.
Am I being heard? Am I being heard?
Hey, I just heard an echo on my voice also. Yeah, I'm hearing an echo on my voice. So it's not him. It's the way the system is set up. Are you hearing an echo on my voice also, John?
Yes, I am, Dick. I look for the drop.
And can you hear me, guys? Yeah, I can hear myself.
Now, let's let it drop and see if things get reset.
That was one thing, and the other one was how to go to that page 543 or something, and that was the yoke ferrite with windings and all this specific information about it.
And did he give enough information? I don't remember this one now. Did he give enough information that you knew the new metal, the new level of the yoke material and its physical dimensions? Because if I picked up two different brands of television sets and take apart the yoke mechanisms, I think there is a possibility that although the ferrite material may look the same, it might not be the same. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, right. And to XGN. No, I know the dimensions like I was him. That's what I wanted to point you, and I specifically pointed to go to that particular page. Look at exactly at what is there. It's only 8 days old, that information. So I was, that's what is important for me. Now, the dimension and the material. Yes, you're right. The deflection yoke consists from the horizontal coils and vertical coils. Which is a very much similar setup as it is in nuclear magnetic resonance devices. They have a wound on the ferrite core and the mounting structure. Sometimes you have a little magnet or rubber ferrite strips that may be glued into the strategic location. So I remember from the old time I was told don't disturb them. And in some rare instances there were additional coils, and there was a very much precise magnetic flux characteristic of this layer. So the geometry of this ferrite is quite unique. Later on, Toshiba and Sony decided they want to go with the cylindrical two halves of the ferrite, but mostly they were using something that was, John would probably be able to describe that better, John?
Yes, they went to conical shape yokes instead of the tube type of ferrite. Geometry is not uniform. It tapers and it has convolutions in it. So I imagine that makes a difference between different birds. Back to you.
Yeah, and I have the addition. From 1955 to 1965, when the ferrite were first applied, the electron beam deflection was manganium zinc. And then, nickel zinc ferrite. And that was providing lower resistance. Then manganium zinc ferrites were used with the subtle toroidal winding, but due to the ringing problems, again, I pointed to ringing problems, they were gradually replaced with a nickel zinc ferrite, which featured higher resistance. Now, Japanese make mainly manganium zinc ferrite for their low material cost. And the maximum frequency usually was 120 kHz for the horizontal scanning frequency of these deflection yokes. Now, what I have concentrated myself is a ringing of the signal. So the set of the information that I was sending you for the past few weeks it was related to... Let me jump. To that, in electronic signal processing and video ringing is unwanted oscillation of the signal, particularly in the step response to the response of the sudden change in input. It is also known as a hunting. It is closely related to overshoot, generally occurring throwing overshoot, and those terms are the time confined. It is also known as the ripple, or particularly in the electricity frequency domain response. Now, we need that. We need that effect. We need to trim that effect. The device is very simple. And I have a few questions about that device. There is a ferrite from the yoke. And there has two halves. These two halves are separated with the piece of paper. What we find out today after the session of probably 10 hours is that when we change the distance, we're getting the highest amplitude at the output of the device, but not more than 1 millimeter. So that would be approximately less than 1/16 of an inch, something like that. Probably a little bit more. John?
No, I have nothing to add, Wes. Dick, pick it up.
I was asking you, the 1/16 of an inch is a little bit less than millimeter?
It's close enough.
Okay, so that's one of the tuning factors. Now, on one half of the ferrite, we have a 50 winds and 15 winds. On the other half, we have a bifilar. Now, the bifilar is connected this way, that you have two wires together, and the beginning of one is connected to the end of the second one. Then we have two wires as an output. This is connected to the load. Now, we were simply trying to find a certain factors about it. At the first material that I have sent you, there was a video showing the typical transformer from the flyback from the TV is able to have beautiful sine wave out of the square wave that is delivered, or any kind of shape, ramp, square, anything that you want, at a certain resonance frequency. I did that. And when I had a conversation with Glenn, he was kind of surprised with that. The amplitude is absolutely even. We've got the same with that yoke ferrite. Now, when I put on 50 watts, when I put the sweep generated from the vector network analyzer at the winding that is horizontal winding, and it's only the U-shape winding around the half of the ferrite, I've got a beautiful response, about 1.3 megahertz. In some other ferrites, to up 1.9 megahertz. I have a significant presence of a peak, and what I did then is change that. We put that 1.2 or 1.3 mega, exactly that frequency, from the generator, and then we were trying to find out, because we have two different magnetic fluxes, one is horizontal, one is vertical, what would be the strongest point on the 50 winds back. So we deliver the square wave to that U-shape wind. Now, at 50 winds, we find 400 and change kilohertz. That was the highest point. Now, what we did is we disconnected that U-shape first winding, horizontal winding, from the top of the ferrite yoke, and we connected a frequency of 400 and change from the signal generator. Now, we put two halves together, and the bifilar on the other half was connected to the load, as well as it was connected to anything that we had in hand at that time. Now, the device was driven from 5 watts on one generator, which was connected to 50 watts. And we were trying to tune that little bit left from that highest peak, a little bit right from that highest peak, to get the maximum on the output. Then we connected to 15 watts, that was on the same half as the 50 watts, 50 hertz. Now the 50 hertz was connected from the additional generator, again 5 watts. And we modulated that first winding 50 on 15 winds, which was with 50 hertz, with the second one that was 400 and change kilohertz. All of a sudden, we've got an extremely nice response on the B-filler. I'm trying to understand what is happening there. I think that you've got familiar with that already, and this was published in that book also. I believe it's worth the effort and discussion. Back to you.
Okay, in the beginning of your most recent email, where the 6,000 or 600 page book, you said to go to page 35. That was the very next chapter. What page should I go to now to see the circuit you're now discussing, Wes? Go ahead.
It was 535 or 534, I believe. I sent you two links. One of them was just the brief summary of new development and of the new publications or changes to the publication. And the second one, and on the second line of that link, you see exactly a few names, probably familiar to you. And that will give you exact information where to go. Probably it was 534 or 535, something like that. You're going to see a piece of ferrite that was the early development, and then you see exactly the winding, some information that is there, but actually that's what I'm referring to, is exactly what is there.
Wesley, don't you have that up on your screen now so you can give them exact information so prevent them from wasting time hunting?
Okay, I'm going to do right now. Go right now there. I hope I'm going to get it very fast. Go to 5534. Just a moment.
First of all, is it in the first link or the second link?
The first thing was only the brief summary. Second line are from the top. You see the names and you see the chapter. I just don't have this email open right now. I'm sorry, I was not prepared for it.
Are you saying you should go to the second link?
Yeah, we don't have the one of the link is the book and the other one is just summary. It got it. I have it. Okay. Hold on. Go to 535. It starts from 534.
Yeah, 534 talks about Mr. Pierre Luigi.
Yes, and the second one. It's 535. The coefficient factor equals 1 to 100. It's 100, 1 kilowatt out. In 2011, development of high performance storage solid state generator. And then you see the names on it. This is an important development being undertaken by You see the names of this gentleman in here.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, I think page 535 has got the four color pictures. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've been listening a little bit here in the background, and one of the interesting things is Wesley describes a flyback transformer where the where one of the windings is being driven by a, I guess, a square wave generator, and on the one of the other windings, what he's seeing is, I guess, a square wave with a sine wave output, and describes that as a resonance. And my general feeling and suspicion is that that's probably not a resonance. What that more than likely is, it's a filtered harmonic being caused by leakage inductance and interwinding capacitance. So what's really happening there is that at some frequency that isn't being loaded, basically the harmonic will pass right through. So if you were to just take a random frequency square wave generator and fly it into feed it into a as a low impedance generator into one of the windings, eventually you could probably hit the frequency where you get a unfiltered harmonic come out as a sine wave. Just a thought. KC2QIQ.
Is it possible that the square wave going in is the impulse function, the reason, the rising edges and the falling edges, and the so-called sine wave coming out is really a damped ringing action during each half of the square wave? Is that possibly what's going on, Glenn?
Well, that typically happens when there's a rectifier involved, in other words, where there's a discontinuity in the current. So, in other words, if you have, basically like a low impedance square wave generator, and then like a switch turns off and a diode conducts, during that time of discontinuity in the current or during the conduction of continuity, during one of those switching impulses, yes, you'll definitely have a ringing. But I'm just suggesting if you have a generator where it's a continuous low impedance driving by a low impedance square wave generator, and you do see at some frequency of the square wave being fed in, more than likely it's probably a filtered harmonic that's coming out associated to leakage inductance and interwinding capacitance.
There's no diet in the circuitry. At first, there is a air gap or paper piece of paper between two halves. If that helps a little, Glenn.
Maybe what Glenn is saying is that the square wave is very rich in the odd harmonics, and then if you've got a resonance on one of those odd harmonic frequencies, you will get a continuous sine wave out of that frequency. So, and it's able to exist because of resonance and leakage reactance. If there was zero leakage reactance between a primary and a very low impedance signal generator and a secondary, and no saturation or leakage is taking place, then only that square wave could come out. But with leakage reactance, with resonance, and a very low impedance sig gen, one of those odd harmonics is capable of being filtered and passed through the circuit. I think that's what you're saying. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, what's interesting about the word resonance and transformers are, resonance on transformers is a pretty wicked and violent thing. Generally, once you have a resonant condition in a transformer, the magnetic material that's doing the coupling generally goes into saturation, and you get very, very ratchety-looking waveforms that come out, very distorted-looking things. But if you see nice-looking sine waves coming out, more than likely what's happening is it's not a real resonance, what you're seeing, but a more of a reactively filtered sine wave. In other words, because the square wave is very, very rich in harmonics, and if you have a filtering impedance associated to leakage inductance and the interwinding capacitance, you could basically wind up with a filtered reaction that will basically just filter out a very, very nice sine wave at one frequency without driving a resonance into the transformer cores and a very, very large distortion.
I wonder how would you then explain that flyback, forget for a moment about what we're talking about, that was driven to the pure, even amplitude sine wave at the output, was that cold? Was not even getting hot. under the load into Exia. With the and being fed with the square wave from the primer.
Well, I think that's precisely what I'm saying, Wesley. In order to get a square wave to come out, in other words, if you're driving like with a voltage-fed generator, in other words, where it's a low impedance generator driving a winding with a square wave, and you're winding up with sine waves on the other side. Generally what that's saying is that the coupling is poor at the frequency that you're trying to couple the sine wave. If you were to probably lower the frequency to a much lower frequency where the rise time of the square wave can actually be within the time constant of whatever leakage inductance and interwinding capacitance can be maintained, you'll see a representation of a square wave. But if you go high enough in frequency with your square wave generator, the rising and fall times of the waveform aren't going to make it through the transformer. It's going to be all rounded off into a sine wave. And that's not a resonance. It's really just a filtering effect of the leakage inductance and the interwinding capacitance, KC2QIQ.
What is strange in what you're saying, and one of the links that I have sent you before, Dick, the video that I have made, is showing that effect, that the voltage was the highest. So the 1 volt deliver from the generator to the primary, say 900 volts out, that was the highest voltage that was I was able to achieve in any particular. I had no ringing pattern present at all, very much even amplitude of the sine wave. Then, of course, five people were present at that particular part of the experiment when we introduced the spark gap into that, and successfully we were driven a significant amount of power out of that transformer. The transformer was dead cold. And to XGM.
WS2N.
And you need, go ahead, Paul.
Put me down for a topic we covered a little bit earlier with the acoustic refrigeration deck. I just have an update on that.
Okay, we'll get to you in a few minutes. One of the things you're saying, Glenn, that I'm having a little bit of a problem with, and that is, if I've got an extremely high quality square wave generator, the rise time and the fall time of the square wave generator, in theory, it doesn't change just because I've asked it to make a 100 hertz sine wave or a 100 kilohertz sine wave. If it's a very high quality signal generator, the rise time is very close to the same time. They don't all really meet that criteria, but in theory they do. So therefore, I think it's only the harmonics of the square wave itself that get filtered to some degree by the circuitry we're discussing. But changing the frequency shouldn't change the rate of rise or fall. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Actually, that's precisely what I'm saying, Dick. In other words, what I'm saying, though, is that if you are at a low enough frequency for the bandpass of the transformer, you'll see what resembles the square wave on the secondary windings. If you keep on increasing the frequency of the square wave generator, eventually what will happen is, yes, the primary winding will still look like a very, very nice square wave, but if you go high enough frequency, the interwinding capacitance and the leakage inductance of the transformer are going to smooth the rise and fall times of the transformer to the point that those smoothings will eventually start looking like a sine wave. So even if you're measuring the primary at a high enough frequency will still have a good-looking voltage-fed square wave on it, but the coupling due to leakage inductance and interwinding capacitance on the secondary windings at a high enough frequency, those rise and fall times now will be so softened up and down that they can't create square waves anymore. It just starts looking like a sine wave. Does that make more sense? KC2QIQ.
Yes, it does. Every real transformer has got some amount of, as you said, interwinding capacitance across the leads of the secondary winding itself. and the core itself has a frequency response to it. If it was a tape-wound toroid, you talk about the thickness of the tape. It's a ferrite choroid, you talk about the grain size of the ferrite and how well they're insulated from each other. So every transformer has got a high frequency, number of high frequency limitations. If I keep the square wave identical in volts and I move it to lower and lower frequencies, at first what comes out of the secondary does look like a pretty good square wave, but eventually when I get low enough in frequency of the constant voltage signal generator, I start running into saturation phenomena. If I keep the voltage constant and I go low enough in frequency, every transformer, the core, will saturate. That's my belief. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
If the frequency is so low that it goes beyond the design parameters of the transformer, because one could always design the transformer for lower and lower frequency just by adding more and more turns to the primary winding. So if you have enough turns, basically you can reduce the primary flux on the core such that you can, you know, allow for it. Obviously, that's why a 60-cycle transformer has a tremendous amount of turns, and when you're doing a 100 kilohertz transformer, you can get away with, you know, go from hundreds of turns to maybe only something like, you know, 25 or 30 turns. So, and looking at also the cross-sectional area of the transformer. So you can design it, but you're right. If you have a fixed transformer and you go keep on going lower and lower in frequency with a fixed volt seconds across the transformer, and you go below its minimum frequency range, the transformer will start to saturate. That's correct, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So for a known number of turns, there is a volt seconds at which you start approaching saturation. And I guess it's really volt second turns. No, the other way around. Volt seconds over turns. More turns, you're going to get less saturation for a given frequency. Now, yeah, you get some really weird effects when the transformer starts saturating.
Yeah, but before we go for it, the primary is on the flyback is only very little amount of winds. Because we have, let's say, from 1 volt, we have a 900 volt. So it's 900 volt to 900 winds to one. If we could name it this way, that's what we're having. Now you said that the more winds, less saturation. When on the secondary introduce the spark gap, then we have another problem that we cannot agree with Glenn. Let me jump. Glenn doesn't believe that the capacitor could be loaded from one wire only. I have a video that I have made that not only the capacitor, but from one wire only, I can light up the light bulb with two diodes connected to one wire only, and one is reversed, one is the other, and the diode across and the capacitor parallel to the light bulb. That's another problem that we have. As I said, is I have a document standing about that what I'm talking about. What I'm gonna do is compose email that I will have all of the links and information if you can take help me about it, because we are right now in very much critical moment to do where I need your help. So I would appreciate if you be so nice and find the time for it. Dick.
Yeah, Wes just said that apparently some discussions on this have taken place during the week, and there was a area where you had a slight disagreement, Glenn. Want to say a few words on that one now, because I may not have heard that conversation.
Well, as I think as Wesley said, in other words, my general, you know, definition of a low frequency model for a light bulb is that you have a completely closed electrical circuit, and in some of these videos that Wesley has shown, there's a light bulb where only one wire is being attached to a light bulb and it lights. And here again, I mean, I've seen similar effects like this myself, where, you know, just tuning something RF and I've had an LED in a box and I could see if something was leaking pretty bad, the LED will light just due to the RF. So, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, there's always a way with an RF signal or something getting in there that will always light the light bulb, but that's not the typical model that we use for in power equations for modeling a light bulb lighting with a circuit where there's a wire going in and a return path, where we're measuring, you know, volts, amperes, power factor, and real power, if you follow what I'm saying. But K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Especially with 0.2 amps and 10 volts and 150 watts out. That's very amazing. And to exceed.
Glenn, I think I heard a portion of a conversation during the week in which you were expressing the opinion that you wished most of the light bulbs were incandescent light bulbs, which means they represent a real resistive load. That if we use something like fluorescent or complex fluorescent bulbs, that you can sometimes get some peculiar effects that are a little bit more difficult to interpret. In fact, you and I have both used RF transmitters near a fluorescent long, 4-foot tube, and you can light it up with no connection to anything. So a real pure load would be an incandescent bulb, and I think you're saying that unless you're getting some kind of resonant in the wire hanging off of it, with one single wire going to a series of incandescent bulbs, how their lighting becomes more difficult to explain. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's precisely it, Dick. You know, it's, when you start talking about, one wire attachments, there is something completing the path. In other words, there's, how we're actually completing the model in a high frequency model. It's, there is no model for just a single node power circuit. You know, you need more than one node. You have to have KVL. You have to draw your Thevenin or Norton equivalents. I mean, somehow that circuit has to be complete. Whether it's being done with an RF wave or something else happening in between, something is completing it. But it's not clearly modeled. That's correct. And here again, as far as the resistive light bulbs, yes, they tend to be lower in noise and other things, but I think the efficiency today is really taking precedence with the amount of power loss. And there are technologies, my company also that I work for is really involved heavily in it, where we are making drivers for the fluorescent tubes and LED drivers and things that are fixing these problems, but they're not easy ones to fix, if you know what I mean, Dick. Back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, on the subject of light-emitting diodes, which you work with a lot, Glenn, if I had a particular light-emitting diode that happens to run pretty nicely on DC, and I start feeding AC into it of the proper magnitude, maybe there's some DC superimposed on the AC, and I start raising the AC to higher and higher frequencies, does a light-emitting diode at higher frequencies, with or without DC simultaneously being present, do you get some peculiar effects? More efficiency, less efficiency, shift in wavelength, or whatever. What happens to light-emitting diodes if I start feeding them at RF frequencies? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, there's a lot of negative things that happen. The problem is when you start going to higher frequencies, the color chrominance of the LED can be maintained. So, and there are also things called PWMing circuits that control the dimming circuits on them, and some of them are actually working pretty good, and those frequencies tend to be around the 1 kilohertz, between 250 to 1 kilohertz in dimmers, where you control a pulse width modulator to basically control dimming, and it works quite well, and the color quality of the LED is good. If you go much higher in frequency, it starts creating EMI problems, and of course, if you go higher in frequency, there are more losses involved. So generally, the LEDs do perform best with DC, very well-controlled DC currents through them with as minimum ripple as possible. The problem with low-frequency ripple currents through the LED diode is that you start getting flicker. And if you have one LED by itself or a group of LEDs driven by one source with high low-frequency ripple, you may not immediately see the distortion in the light. Let me let it drop. But the problem that we're seeing with the LEDs with low frequency ripple is you may see imaging problems with the LED, like you'll see, like if you hold your hand, you'll see like shadowing effects that aren't very pretty. Another problem with the light is that if you have a television in the room that's got a certain scan rate or a computer monitor, and if the frequency of the LED ripple is too low, it could start mixing and creating a beat frequency between the television and other things. So here again, the more you keep to DC, I think, the better off your light quality will be. And if you do have to dim it, a very, very good frequency for dimming is 1 kilohertz stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WH Warrior, I would question.
Joe, recognize. Let me drop. I'm guessing if I slowly sneak up on the DC voltage into a light-emitting diode, there's an ideal voltage where it gives good efficiency in light output versus watts input, and also good life. I could go to a slightly higher voltage, get a little bit more light output, but my life starts going down real fast. I am guessing that that ideal point is the point you go to with pulse width modulation, that each individual pulse is at that ideal voltage. And now by changing the average time that the bulb is on by the pulse width modulation, the human eye integrates that into thinking the light is dimmer. The actual amount of light that's there during the on time is essentially the same, although maybe you could push it a little bit if there's a thermal effect that creates a life decrease, where when the pulse width modulation is low enough, maybe you could go a little bit higher in the voltage without affecting the life. Have there been experiments along those lines, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, absolutely. In the last 10 years, there's been such research in this area. Moving LEDs and the technology has moved so far, it's unbelievable. I'm sure you've heard of the company called Cree. They're a silicon manufacturer, and they have a very, very big development with the in the LED area. And what they've determined, as most of the LED manufacturers today, are that the best way to drive an LED is with constant current in series strings. Because with time and temperature, the voltage across an LED will shift. But if you maintain a constant current, you can keep the amplitude in lumens coming out of the LED very, very consistent with a constant current. So when we do pulse width modulate, we're really pulse width modulating a constant current. Or in strict in DC, we're just keeping a very, very well regulated constant current, and you can change the number of LEDs in the string, and or with aging, the voltage can shift with time and temperature and still maintain the same constant current. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment.
I think I'm seeing that there's a real safe idea of using constant current, that if I used constant voltage, and if something went wrong and the bulb starts running hot, that it really wants a lower voltage when it runs hot, and if you've got a constant voltage, you can get into a runaway condition, particularly a series string. My guess is the whole string is a lot happier if it's fed with a constant current generator. Is that true, Glenn? Answer that one and then send it back to Wesley. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's exactly it, Dick. The safest way to run LEDs and get the maximum life out of them is to look at their rating and run a constant current through the LED that's very, very well maintained, and allow the voltage to swing across the light. If they get cold, basically the voltage is going to want to go up. If the temperature gets hot, it's going to want to go down. So you allow that to happen naturally and just keep the constant current through it, and the LED will live a very, very long, happy life. On that note, let me pass it over to Wesley. It's all yours, Wes. KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Tim. Always a pleasure to have your help online. Dick, if you go to my email that I have sent you, and then you look at the number of links that I have sent you, one is with the yellow on it, and then you go down till you see, read this. And it's HTTP, free energy, and whatsoever. and then it's IDOT at the end, and you click on it. Now, when you get there, there are two devices that I was experimenting with, and then you go down, you see the exactly the schematic, or the device that I'm talking about are made on the ferrite yoke is made, and then below you have a complete schematic of two schematics. Let me jump. Of how this, the device is built with two generators on the left-hand side and a light bulb on the right-hand side. Then you go lower and you will see exactly how physically this ferrite will wind it. And you should have also below the scope shots, yes. I see in here scope shots of that experiment. Apart from that, you have not really very good quality of the video that is close to 2 hours long, and this one is also showing that the measurement and tuning of the device in progress. Now, recently there was another one that was added, and I'm going to send you the link to it. I would like you to see the schematic, because that will give you exactly the idea how this device was built and to exchange.
I did see a number of schematics over the last couple of weeks where one of the windings has a pair of diodes that in turn feed the winding of another transformer-like device.
That was the first device that was based on TK. It was working. About 600 watts, 1 kilowatt out. But what is interesting with this particular one is this one is on one of half of the ferrite is 50 winds and 15 winds. The other one has 150 winds of bifidar, where the beginning of the first one is connected to the second one. That a bank of capacitor that is connected in parallel that is winding in the light bulb. This one was probably 20 minutes with 600 watts on it. The maximum was 1 kilowatt. Now, it is exactly in line with what is on the book also. But did you get to that particular link that I said? First, see that. It says, first read this. First, read this. And then HTTP, colon, and free energy and whatsoever. When you look at the from the top, past the yellow, and then go down just a little, and then you see first read this. Page opens, then you go down till you see the schematics. There are two schematics. One is with variable capacitors, one is with bank of capacitors. And the two generators are on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side you see the light bulb and the bank of capacitors.
Was that shipped on November 9th at 7.05 p.m.? Is that the email you're speaking of?
It's a publication of 6,000 pages as e-books. That's the title on that email.
Okay, that's the one I'm looking at. And I'm now looking for the sentence that says, see this one first.
You pass the yellow. You see Mr. Allen, pass that yellow, then you go down. One of the most complete discoveries. You pass that, then you see the link. You pass that link, and then right below that, a short text, and then it says, first read this.
Okay, I found the first read this, and I'm opening that up right now. While that's opening up, Joe, W2RYY, go ahead with your question.
Hi, thank you, Dick. I don't know if I've